The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, and joining you on a fine Wednesday morning from the capital of Germany, where the record-breaking 32 Grammy Award winner Beyoncé has caused a scandal this week by announcing a world tour with dates in Frankfurt, Cologne and Hamburg, but not Berlin, prompting the Berliner Zeitung to shriek, "Beyoncé swerves Berlin." My name is Daniel Frieber. I am the host of this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will not swerve cyclocross and the World Championships at the weekend, or indeed the racing that's taken place on the road in recent days. And we will find out why the great nation of Belgium may soon be crazy in love with a rider who was very much in the thick of the action and burnishing his halo at the weekend. Joining me to do all of that, doing so from a place very close to my heart after my storied trip there a few weeks ago, i.e. the Grenken Velodrome in Switzerland. It's a man who may be Belgium's answer to Beyoncé, so beloved is his voice there. He's also the only individual guaranteed to beat Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel to every finish line. Last time he appeared on the podcast, he revealed Remco Evenepoel's penchant for a self-help book. Hence, this time we'll wait with bated breath for full disclosure about Van Aert's love of Renaissance novellas or MVDP's fondness for a celebrity cookbook. He's already been to Argentina this year, as I hinted. He's now poised to cover the European Track Championships. He's a veteran of 24 Tours de France, 22 Giro d'Italia, 4 Vueltas a España. He is the Wheeler Man, and his name is Renaert Schotter. Renaert, you've disappointed me already this morning by telling me you weren't at the Cyclocross Worlds at the weekend, which is shocking.
Daniel, I'm a bit blown away by your intro there. As we start the broadcast, they pump up the volume at the cycling track here in Grenken. So I was kind of jet-lagged from the Argentina trip. I covered San Juan. I'm already in Grenken now on the track for European Championships upcoming. If you hear strange noises in the background, those are the riders having the final training session just before these track Euros. I can tell you that Ganna is here riding in front of my eyes. Elia Viviani I've spotted on the track. Lotte Kopecky is walking around in a rainbow jersey. This is really cycling heaven for a journalist. And I missed Hoogerheide, but I didn't miss it on the other hand because, of course, I was watching it on television, and I was astonished right after the race, like a lot of people, I think, about not the outcome. You could suspect Mathieu van der Poel to be a winner in front of his home crowd, but the way he did it was like magic. I mean, he took a scenario, he chose a scenario completely different than everybody expected before.
Well, Renaert, don't use up all of your best material yet. And also, you've already inflamed one of my allergies by talking about track cycling. We're going to talk about cyclocross later in great detail with our second guest. Also joining me today is a man who returned to centre stage on the Cycling Podcast last week and saw it mainly as an invitation to unleash 6 months of pent-up piss-taking upon yours truly. You'll only get an abridged intro from now on, as I daren't bait him with any more fresh meat. He is the uncaged lion of the Chilterns. He doesn't know this, but he's on a yellow card after last week's antics. He is not Watford's Lionel Burney. Lionel, you look offended. You look put out already.
Hello, Daniel. What's the yellow card for?
Just general insurrection.
Oh, okay. I've been out of the loop for 6 months, Daniel, but who does Beyoncé ride for? Is it SD Works or Canyon SRAM? I've got a lot of catching up to do, I know that.
This will be like me when we start talking about cyclocross later. Lionel, how are you?
I'm very good, yes. I very much enjoyed the cyclocross over the weekend. You won't use up all my best lines, but I did like a friend of the podcast, David Campion, on our Facebook page, made a comment about the men's race, the duel between Wout van Aert and Mathieu van der Poel. He said, "It's like the boat race. I don't know who's leading, but it's either Oxford or Cambridge." Now, for listeners outside the UK, the boat race is held every year, and the only participants are Oxford and Cambridge. And the race on Sunday did feel a little bit like that after about the 3.5 minute mark, didn't it?
That's a pretty good analogy, actually. We'll talk about binary sporting rivalries later on, in fact, and just how great the Van der Poel-Van Aert rivalry is. But let's get straight on to the news roundup for this week. We'll kick off by tying up loose ends from last week. We hit the airwaves with two stages remaining in the Saudi Tour. I confidently predicted that Santiago Buitrago would ultimately take victory overall, but he was outsprinted by Ruben Guerrero on the very spectacular fourth stage. Guerrero, now Movistar, also held onto the leader's jersey the following day on a final stage won by Simone Consonni of Cofidis. Incidentally, chaps, it's been a pretty good start to the season for the Italian riders. Davide Formolo was second overall in Saudi Arabia. Been some other notable Italian performances elsewhere, from Ciccone, for example, in Valenciana. We'll get onto that in a minute. Battistella there as well. Filippo Ganna, who you're about to watch in action today. Renato, any word on Ganna's form? I mean, you watched him in action in Argentina, where he was. We saw him in a kind of unfamiliar guise in the sense that he was, you know, one of the best riders uphill at the Alto de Colorado, wasn't it? Any word on what kind of form he's bringing to the European track champs?
I think 105%, because it wasn't a coincidence that he was that good on that mountaintop finish on Alto de Colorado, because he was really aiming at these Euros, because the importance of these Euro tracks is that it's part of the... it's the start of the Olympic qualification cycle towards Paris 2024, and that's why a lot of high-profile riders like Ganna are really aiming to be at their best at these championships. So I'm quite convinced that Ganna is probably at his best, just trying to outperform the competition here, and they are the reigning Olympic champions, so I'm quite sure they want to make a statement right away here at the Euros, because the other riders from his team were also there in Argentina, so Argentina was important for him. And I think he'll probably use the shape he has then coming out of these Euros to do something in the classic season, because as we all know, track cycling is an excellent layer to build your condition on and to be good in one-day races as well. So I'm curious to see what he's going to do after Grenchen.
I'll give you the barest bones from two other stage races that took place last week, the Etoile de Bessèges and the Vuelta Valenciana, because we'll be talking quite a bit about both of those in part three. I had a very windy Bessèges. The last three stages were won by Arnaud Delis. That was his second of the week. And Matthias Skelmoser was first across the line on Saturday. And on Sunday, clearly very informed Mads Pedersen won the final TT with a nasty uphill finish. The overall was won by Nielsen Paulus. Also the winner of the GP La Marseillaise last week, which you attended, Lionel. Thus proving that the curse of La Marseillaise is pure baloney, or foutaise, as they say in France. At La Valenciana, meanwhile, Simone Velasco won in Sagunto. The former Giro d'Italia winner Theo Gegenhardt took his first victory since that career-defining success in 2020. And that wily old wolf, Rui Costa, yanked everyone's bib shorts down and tore the leader's jersey off Giulio Ciccone's back with a late attack to take the stage and overall on Sunday. As I said, we'll talk about both of those races later. There's also a significant one-day race at the weekend, the Colombian National Championships. That was won by Esteban Chavez of EF Education First Easy Post. Chavez is now 33, but still looks young enough to deliver your morning papers. Second there was Dani Martinez. Third was the teamless Nairo Quintana in a logoless bright white jersey on a fluorescent yellow BMC. Chaps, did you see the pictures of that race? I mean, the crowds were astonishing and the racing was chaotic. And it was like watching a different sport. It was just so vibrant. The atmosphere was febrile. The attacks just kept coming. And I know there was a lot of talk afterwards from some of our Colombian colleagues about what a shame it is that Colombia doesn't have a major race in light of the atmosphere that we saw at the weekend. And I couldn't help but agree when I watched a little bit of the Colombian nationals at the weekend.
I was actually very, very charmed by the pictures I saw, and the emotion Chavez displayed after his win was like he'd become world champion, and that is really something, and it illustrates the importance of cycling in Colombia. And I must say, me too, I am sad there is no longer a Colombia 2.1 race there, because it was on my to-do list, but then the race got into the corona troubles, and then it didn't come back after the COVID crisis. So I'm still hoping and praying that one day it'll come back, because if you see the whole scene you described there, of course, Colombia really deserves to have a high-level race there. And I have vivid memories of my, for the moment, first and only visit to Colombia for cycling reasons. And that was my very first Worlds back in 95. I was a bit too young to understand the magnitude of cycling at that point in Colombia, but I do now, and I hope to go back soon there, and think every cycling journalist is somehow dreaming about going to Colombia to cover a race there.
I mentioned Nairo Mann, Nairo Quintana. Meanwhile, his old team, Arkea Samsic, seems to have its financial future secured until the end of 2025. The main sponsor, Arkea, having extended their contract until that date this week. More news, not about a race itself, but a race program, namely Tadej Pogacar's. Pog has announced he will start his season at the rather lovely part road, part gravel race, Paraíso Interior, on February 13th, and thereafter stay in Andalusia to ride the Ruta del Sol. This, of course, means that he won't defend his title at the UAE Tour, and that his now UAE teammate, Adam Yates, will surely finally win again on Jebel Hafit after two consecutive Pogcinerations, although Yates did win there in 2020. Renat, I say that Adam Yates now becomes a sort of de facto favourite for UAE, but Remco, your old mate Remco, and your countryman will also be in UAE, so it might be quite a battle.
But I think he's going to try and win that race there, and now having Pogacar not being present is of course an assist to go for the win there. That being said, I think it's astonishing that Pogacar is not doing UAE, or astonishing is maybe not the word, but surprising, because it's the first time he's not going to do his sponsor's home race. And I think, in a way, I wouldn't call it disturbing, but it shows that the team has gotten completely grown up and customized with habits in cycling. They know that the importance of the race is there, but there are bigger goals, and that bigger goal for sure is this year the Tour de France again. And I think inside they probably think we have to stimulate Pogacar. Doing new races might give him a new build up, a new elan to perform again like he should in the Tour de France. I think that's maybe the reasoning behind. In Flemish we have this saying, if you're hungry, you tend to eat more. I can't translate it correctly, but different races can create more race hunger.
I thought all Flemish idioms involved the church, a church, a village church.
If the church bell rings, it's time for lunch. I think that's one, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's that one. Yeah,
but it's true. It's true. Some of those expressions, a lot of them have to do with the church, like hold the kerk in the middle, how to keep the church in the middle. That's really difficult in a race, though.
In Germany, they all involve a sausage of some sort, pretty much. Well, 75% of idiomatic expressions involve sausage.
If the church bell rings, it's time for sausages for lunch. I think that's what we say in North Watford.
Yeah. Incidentally, on Pogacar, he rode the Sanremo finale yesterday. Lionel, unlike you, he's not cagey about what he shares on Strava. That was definitely not the most newsworthy thing to happen in Sanremo yesterday. The festival, the famous song contest, is going on at the moment. Chiara Ferragni's monologue is front page news in all of the Italian papers this morning.
Sorry, well, I was going to say, I hope he's not preparing for Milan San Remo, because that would be a wasted effort. Milan San Remo no longer exists, or it's certainly not taking place this year, is it? Big change to the start town.
That's true, actually. That should have been in the news.
It's Abbiate Grasso San Remo.
Not catchy, is it?
No, but you can get good risotto in Abbiate Grasso and those parts of the world just to the west of Milan. But I don't think it changes that much, does it? It's just a bit less of Po Basin that the riders will have to do before they get to the Turchino. Chaps, talking of Sanremo, former Sanremo winners, bit of Mark Cavendish news. He'll make his 2023 debut in an Astana jersey at the Tour of Oman this week. And he's also given a rare interview to our friend Matt Dickinson from the Times newspaper. In it, Cavendish talked about how refreshing it's been to find himself in a team where, in his words, he doesn't have to justify himself. I've been in teams where I've been idolised, and that's hard. You feel isolated. You feel that pressure. Been in teams where I've been kicked, not physically, but that's also not nice. Here, I just feel respected for what I've achieved. Also about the Eddy Merckx, the infamous Eddy Merckx record, which he shares, the number of Tour de France stage wins. He said, everyone talks about the Merckx record, but if it was about setting a number, I could stop now. I hold the most wins at the Tour de France. Renard, I don't think we've had Lionel's view on this either yet. Cavendish, Astana, will it be a marriage made in heaven or hell, do you think?
Oh, very difficult question that. I really don't know. The best thing is that it gives him a very clear run at the Tour de France. I mean, Astana is not a team that has another focus, especially now Miguel Angel Lopez is not in the team. This is something that you've talked about a few weeks ago when it was finally confirmed that Cavendish was going to go to Astana. I think the best he could really hope for after the collapse of B&B Hotels was to be in a team that is guaranteed to ride in the Tour de France. So that's a big tick. And to have an opportunity within that team to be, you know, in the top sort of echelon of riders, able to kind of set a race program that will suit him in the build up to the Tour de France, not feel maybe that pressure that he had to meet certain targets early in the year to kind of justify a place in the Tour. Astana really don't have a huge amount else going for them. And for Astana, it's a similarly free hit. You know, they might not be able to put an A team behind Mark Cavendish in terms of, you know, sprint lead out, but they've got Case Bol, who is fast. They'll be able to put something together, and they've got time to work on it in other races. I think in terms of, you know, putting aside the fact that Astana's got a, you know, a very sort of up and down and slightly checkered history, and it's a bit of a weird match in terms of, you know, one of the biggest stars in the sport riding with a Kazakh team with the history it has, and for a team boss of you know, with his past, Alexander Vinokourov, put all that to the side on a purely sort of sporting sense, I don't think Cavendish could have hoped for more, really, because it gives him freedom, a certain lack of pressure, but with enough of that drive and expectation that he will get a chance to ride the races he wants to ride. I he didn't have a pick of World Tour teams, did he? So probably the best solution that he could have found.
Renard, what's your gut feeling about this deal? How does it smell to you?
Well, it's interesting what Lionel says there about Case Bol as a lead out, because the Dutchman doesn't really have experience in that kind of job. So I think he'll have to adjust, because if you're sprinting for yourself, it's a different ball game than doing the lead out for might be a world-class sprinter. But emotionally, of course, as a Belgian, I'm opposed 100% against Cavendish breaking the Merckx record. But of course, he's a good chap and he deserves that number 35. But from an emotional point of view, as a Belgian, I say, no, don't break the Merckx record, because that's really blasphemy or something else in the church.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much to our title sponsors, Super Sapiens. Now, Super Sapiens have their own podcast. It's called the Super Sapiens Podcast, and you can listen to it wherever you're listening to the Cycling Podcast. It's hosted by Zylon van Eck and Dr. David Littman, who, Daniel, you may be interested to know, as well as being an eminent sports scientist, is also deep into his London Marathon training. Now, the most recent episode of the Super Sapiens Podcast features a long-distance time trialist, the American Ryan Collins, who was on course for the US Olympic team, but then was hit by a car and has had to kind of readjust his career and his goals. He's back racing now, and he is the US 12-hour time trial champion. Daniel, I know you love time trialing. 12 hours of time trialing is obviously exponentially better than a good British 10-mile time trial. Anyway, Ryan Collins has talked in the recent episode all about how he manages his energy levels and gains insights into his own training and performance, particularly important for an event that lasts 12 hours. The podcast's a really interesting listen, and if you want to find out more about Super Sapiens, it's a great place to start, as is the website supersapiens.com.
Well, Renard, you talked about committing blasphemy before the break, the blasphemy of wanting Mark Cavendish to to beat the Eddie Merckx record or not. I committed a kind of blasphemy or heresy, certainly for my personal code of conduct, by watching the cyclocross of the weekend. I certainly watched a replay. I didn't get the PhD in cyclocross. I said that I would last week. But I paid pretty close attention to what was, by all accounts, a raucous World Championship weekend. 50,000 people, I guess 50,000 people on each day, or on the Sunday, was it, Renat?
There were figures about ranging from 38,000 to 50,000 just for the Sunday, yeah.
We got to see, certainly in the men's race, and I would argue in the women's as well, because we've also had some great rivalries, or a great rivalry there this year. We got to see the show that everyone was lusting for, thirsting for, Van Aert versus Van der Poel. Question for you, Renard. Well, we know you weren't there, but you were watching. Did it live up to expectations, the race itself? We should also say that Mathieu Van der Poel took the world title.
For me personally, no. That might come as a surprise, but I was a bit disappointed with how the race went. Not with the outcome. I mean, the outcome, okay, the outcome was great. That was a great finale. But I missed Tom Pidcock at these Worlds, because I think with his presence, the race would have been different. And what you had now was like a blistering beginning by Mathieu van der Poel, showing off in the first round, about nearly holding the wheel, as he said afterwards. That was a fact, apparently. Everybody thought, okay, maybe he's comfortably in that wheel.
It looked to me, the cyclocross heathen, as though Van Aert or Van der Poel had Van Aert on a fraying leash. The leash sort of frayed over the course, or it looked as though it was fraying over the course of the first half an hour, and that it was going to break at one point. It didn't. I mean, I saw the quotes from Van Aert, and he talked about how he found the first half hour very difficult, and then he seemed to get a little bit more comfortable. But anyway, go on, Van Aert.
Yeah, judging by his comments afterwards, your perception is right. And then the strange thing, as opposed to races earlier this season, was that after that first war, the first three rounds, then the pace really got less. And at one point they had like more than half a minute advantage on the first guys in the pursuit. And then suddenly it was a mere 15 seconds. And that is really... I'd say for the recent scenarios we've seen in cyclocross, unseen, because nowadays they do the race from A to Z and they go full gas all the way. They didn't do that at this world, and I think in the end that was a disadvantage for Van Aert, because if we'd seen a third guy, the third dog in the game, for instance Tom Pidcock, I think the only one possible to do it, then the race would have gone into the red all the way, like we saw in Dijham in the Christmas period. That race was, from my point of view, the best race of the season. Okay, not as important as Worlds, of course, obviously not. But the scenes we saw after that race, we had the three guys battling it out, Wout, Mathieu and Tom. And then afterwards, one of the first comments of Wout after that race was, this was not healthy. I would have loved to hear him that say after Worlds, and he didn't say that, and it was a matter of emotion and analysis, and on in that way I was a bit, I wouldn't say disappointed, but I'd have liked to see a race that went all the way full gas, because that's what cyclocross nowadays is, like it's like a 1 hour time trial with explosions and riders get dropped and stuff like that. That for me, that's the most interesting aspect of modern day present cyclocross. So I miss that. So Tom, never ever, I hope Tom Pidcock never ever again forfeits for Worlds.
What does the seasoned former president of the Sven Nys fan club, the UK branch, think?
Well, I was delighted that Thibaut, his son, won the under-23 world title. So maybe there's an opening there as president of the Thibaut Nys fan club at some point.
Yeah, the Thibaut Pinot UK fan club is already spoken for.
It is. Sorry, that was nearly a slip. Yeah, I mean, Renard, I think Tom Pidcock would have introduced that extra element to the race, but on that course, it was a power course, wasn't it? It was a sprinter's course. It was like a road criterium in a lot of ways, firm ground. You know, Van der Poel was clearly the stronger rider, clearly knew he had the better sprint, and the race itself really was just about two sprints. The sprint off the line, which the Dutch did brilliantly, Lars van der Haar and Joris Nieuwenhuis, they really, you know, helped Van der Poel get right up to the front, get into, you know, the sort of first corners right at the start. I mean, they laid down a real marker there. There was never any doubt that Van Aert was going to have any difficulty getting on terms with Van der Poel, but, you know, they really set their stall out right from the start, no messing about. And as I say, between by the 3.5 minute mark, the two of them were away, and it was Van der Poel's repeated accelerations that just basically distanced everybody else. It was very impressive to execute that. And then, of course, it came down to the final sprint, and Van der Poel's sprint was reminiscent, wasn't it, of Amstel Gold a few years ago, or Strada Bianca, perhaps. You know, he took off like a rocket. A bit of controversy on social media about him sprinting on the brake hoods rather than on the drops. I mean, you know, we've seen it before. It's not necessarily conventional. I remember being at Liège-Bastogne-Liège in 2000 when David Echeverria of Once was in with Paolo Bettini and Davide Rebellin, and Bettini won. Rebellin was also sprinting on the drops, as Bettini was, and Echeverria was on the hoods. And, you know, there was a lot of comment then about, Echeverria doesn't really know how to sprint because he's a climber. You know, there's no doubt about, you know, Van der Poel's brilliance on a bike. I mean, you know, the fact that he was not in the optimum position and yet still produce that power maybe came down to the fact that he had the bigger chain ring, you know, which gave him that... you know, gave him just that little bit extra, perhaps. With Van der Poel, you know, his fifth world title, he's getting up there now towards the greats, isn't he? He draws level with Albert Zweifel of Switzerland and André Dufresne of France and Renato Longo of Italy, who have five wins. Eric de Vlaeminck is top of the men's list with seven. Not sure if he's got any llamas. Has Eric got any llamas, Daniel? Or is that just Roger?
I'm not sure, but... Renard, it did make me... I was curious, actually, looking at this, the role of honour, and seeing that Van der Poel was now sort of almost within touching distance of Eric de Vlaeminck. I haven't heard so much from Roger de Vlaeminck in the last couple of years about, you know, usually he had pretty outspoken views on Belgian classics riders, cyclocross races. What did Roger... Do you know what he thought of... Or what's he thought of this season and what he thought about the Worlds on Sunday?
Well, it's true we haven't heard him about it, and maybe it's because he took my advice there for heart to not speak with the media anymore, because that is really okay. Degrading the legend Roger de Vlaeminck.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah.
What a shame.
No. I mean, he's free to do whatever he wants to do, especially if he wants to speak up. But
How's his health? He had some health issues.
Yeah, that's true. But I think it's got better, he'll be a legend forever. And... of course, Roger, as you say in English, he has his heart on his tongue, and he'll never change. And it's not for nothing that he was called in Italy back in the days when he was doing the Giro, when he was winning 22 stages there, when he was the master of Tirreno. They called him Polemico. So nothing's changed, really. Roger de Vlaeminck will always have an opinion that creates dust. Actually, I wanted to refer to the things Lionel was saying. I agree on Van der Poel winning the power display and having the best day at that race, on that race course, because the race course, of course, was also determining the race and the outcome. And I think the surface was against Wout van Aert. Surface is, of course, neutral, but it wasn't ideal for his power display, so in that way he was a bit handicapped. And speaking about Rebellin, I want to add that he was a sprinter, because he won in the mid-90s a 40 bunch group sprint in the Classica San Sebastian, but that doesn't matter. Anyway, the great Rebellin, late Rebellin, sadly, we have to say. But what struck me the most after Hogerheide was the surprise Wout van Aert really exposed after that finish, that sprint finish, because he said, "I forgot to do my sprint," and that really is a shame. I mean, I would have loved to see them do the sprint starting at the same time. And now he was like, he lost it the moment the sprint started, like Lionel said, and it was also a little bit uphill. So that was really something Van Aert should have thought of, and it brought back memories right away of that last Tour of Flanders, where also a slow approach sprint was won by Mathieu van der Poel. That combined with the slight uphill and the fact that Hogerheide is really part of his training course, a straight home win with everything, that makes it legendary, if you ask me.
I was going to say, Renard, I mean, it did look like those two were racing a different event to everybody else. I'm not saying that no one in the rest of the pack managed to ride over the bunny hops, but consistently Van Aert and Van der Poel rode the bunny hops. I know it's a bit more congested and the pace perhaps a bit slower behind and, you know, there's a bit more jostling, so there was a lot more people running on foot. But I do wonder whether actually the two of them, the obstacles need to be a bit higher for them just to force a bit more nuance into the event, because like I say, it was a bit of a criterium type course and it didn't really play to the strength of Van Aert. He needed it to be, you know, perhaps a little bit more technical, places where he could maneuver Van der Poel about a little bit. But actually they kind of rode the same pattern every lap, didn't they? Van der Poel kind of, you know, went on the front, they came onto that road section and Van Aert did a kind of token turn on the front, but it didn't look like he really had the opportunity at any point where he could really put on a bit of pressure. After that half an hour mark, and it's interesting, he did say he struggled in the first half an hour but started to feel a bit better, because after half an hour Van Aert did try to apply a bit of pressure, but it didn't look like there was any chance that Van der Poel was going to crack. And there was nowhere on the course that really tested those two, particularly technically. So there wasn't really the prospect of a mistake. It would have had to have been a catastrophic mistake for anything to happen. Not saying it wasn't an absorbing race, but really you could have condensed it down to sort of, you know, 4.5 minutes.
I have to agree on that. But the course was what it was. I mean, it was a typical Adrie van der Poel course. He likes those clean courses, and I'm not saying he's designed it specifically with his son's abilities in mind, but it's just the kind of race Adrie really loves. You got to give credit to him for building that course, because I know how the course has evolved over the years in Hogerheide, and would be a shame if the race wouldn't stay in the World Cup in the coming seasons. It's a matter of perspective. If you have a different course builder, you'll have a different course. That's just how it goes in cyclocross, and it's part of the game, really.
Chaps, before we move on, I think it'd be worth just spending 5 minutes glorying once again in this fantastic rivalry, which, you know, came to a head again at the weekend. There's not much that we can say that hasn't already been said, but, you know, as someone who hasn't really been bitten by the cyclocross bug, who thinks it's a bit silly to go upstairs with a bike over your shoulder, nonetheless, I can't fail to appreciate, you know, how unique, not just in cycling, but in sport, this rivalry is. I mean, it's quite difficult to find other sports where, other individual sports where you have a rivalry that's been sort of so consistent, which has the longevity of this rivalry. It's been going for an awfully long time. And also the closeness of it, the gladiatorial nature of it. I mean, it's a sort of zero-sum game. It's kill or be killed. I mean, I was just thinking about other individual sports where people might think there have been great rivalries over the years. I mean, tennis is a good example. Obviously, we've had this fantastic generation of Federer and Nadal, and then we've had Djokovic and Djokovic versus Nadal and so forth. But, you know, you compare the number of times that those guys have gone head-to-head with Van der Poel and Van Aert. I mean, Federer has played Nadal. I mean, Lionel, how many times would you guess that Roger Federer and Rafa Nadal have played each other over the years?
I mean, I have no idea.
Go on, have
40?
40, exactly. How did you get that? 40 in 2 decades.
Wow.
But never more than 50 times. I'm sorry, never more than 5 times a year. Federer, Djokovic, 50 times. Rafa Nadal, Djokovic, 60 times. Now, Van der Poel and Van Aert have gone up against each other 180 times over the years, according to cyclocross24.com, and 11 times just this season, where we sort of think of them now as part-time cyclocross riders. And, you know, they're going to have pretty much identical spring programs as well. And I suppose the only thing missing from the rivalry, from my point of view, Renard, is more hostility and more tension and more friction. And it seems to me they've entered even a new phase over the last year or so when there was the threat at one point of this rivalry turning nasty, but it seems they've gained even more respect for each other over the last year or so. What do you think?
No, it's never turned really nasty, and I like that because I've seen those guys grow up in their sport. The first races I covered were their junior races at cyclocross worlds and World Cups, so I can only say that if they wouldn't be as big as they both are in their own range in the sport, then they could be best friends because they have a lot of similarities. But because of their careers, that makes it different for those guys to be friends, really. But what you say about that growing respect is surely right.
What about their fans? How is the tribalism between their fans these days?
That's really difficult for me to judge on because, in my opinion, in cyclocross, the life and or death battle between fans like we used to know in the era between Sven Nys, the chairman is here, of course, and Mario de Klerk and other rivals from Sven Nys was a bit more harsh, and sometimes, as you said, it was more of a battle, and we don't have that anymore. But I think it's a sign of modern times. I mean, you see that in different sports. You see that also in Formula One. They ride almost they cut the corners, and then afterwards in the press conference, nicely arranged, they say blah blah blah, and they respect each other and congratulate each other. You can call it a shame, but at the other hand, I can also call it common sense, because it wouldn't help either Mathieu or either Wout in the development of their careers. They know they're going to confront each other in new races to come, and the next time will be Strade Bianche. That's their next duel. Though it's strange to speak about a duel, because there's another 178 riders starting that race. So that's the nice thing about that rivalry between Mathieu and Wout. We're talking about a rivalry. We're talking about a clash of the titans. We're talking about Rumble in the Jungle. But basically, they're two riders of a big bunch. And the fact that they stand out from that bunch really gives it a very special edge and a magical thing, sort of, that you have to feel privileged to be witness of this cycling era.
The Mall in the Mud, not the Rumble in the Jungle, the Mall in the Mud. I think Van der Poel and Van Aert, certainly on the cyclocross side, they kind of keep each other going. You know, one, if one didn't ride, the other would probably drop
point.
It as well.
Yeah.
They, you know, that they're in it for that duel, for that battle. And I do sometimes wonder, you know, when they've got so many bigger fish to fry, you know, when you look at their ability, their kind of stature in the current sport, which we know the depth of field is so much deeper now than it was even in the 90s, the 80s. You know, I was comparing Mathieu van der Poel's palmarès to his dad, Adrie van der Poel's, and they're roughly similar. You know, we think of Mathieu van der Poel as a kind of Galactico, one of the titans, as he said, Renard. You know, Adrie van der Poel was a really quality classics rider who had a very long career, crossed over with the cyclocross, only won one world title, you know, one Liège, one Amstel, one Flanders, a couple of Tour de France stages. And you wouldn't have said Adrie van der Poel was a Galactico of cycling in the 80s. I mean, close, you know, certainly Premier League, but not of the same stature that Mathieu van der Poel enjoys today. But Mathieu van der Poel, you know, yet to kind of unlock the door to kind of multiple monument wins, as really is Wout van Aert. They're kind of almost cancelling each other out. And so I wonder whether that's part of the motivation to carry on with the cyclocross. You know, if one does it, the other has to do it. I do wonder now Van der Poel's got on to 5 wins, whether he will have his sights set on equaling or surpassing Eric de Vlaeminck's 7, or equaling the greatest of all time, Marianne Vos, who's got 8 world titles, of course. And I can't let the cyclocross section go without just reminding everybody that I saw all this coming 21 years ago when I went to interview Adrie van der Poel at his home in Capellen, just over the border from Hoogeheide. And little Mathieu was pootling around the front room on a little bicycle on a course that I think was designed by Adrie van der Poel. I don't know, possibly. But 2 last comments on the cyclocross before we move on. First of all,
not 2 last comments. Line.
Me,
I can talk about this all day.
Yeah. 2 last things from me, and then a question for Renard. Really, first of all, I think the Dutch should all have been relegated a few places for that jersey. It looked like it had been through the wash. I mean, what's happened to the famous orange? It's a travesty. And just a mention for Cameron Mason, the British rider, to be more precise, Scottish rider. He's from Linlithgow. We've got a lot of friends of the podcast in Linlithgow. He was ninth, the first non-Belgian or Dutch rider. A very good performance for him. But I mean, it's a bit like a Belgian finishing ninth in the Inverness caber tossing competition, isn't it? If such a thing exists.
Our colleague Jan-Peter de Vligo writes for Het Nieuwsblad, was talking to me earlier in the week about cyclocross going to New York, and he was sort of searching for similes or analogies, and I suggested, I don't know, this might be like a Super Bowl in Herrardsbergen or Stroopwafels for Thanksgiving, I don't know.
And my very last question, Renard, just briefly, because we saw some really innovative TV coverage, didn't we, with the drone, which I think was on a wire following them through the woods. It's definitely the level of presentation and the way the event looked felt like a sort of big step on. And I think, you know, with that stadium atmosphere that they have with the 40 or 50,000 people and with this duel between the two greats, you know, it really did look like a great event.
It was a great event. And funny you're mentioning the drone, because the drone was actually introduced in cyclocross for the very first time, not this winter, but last winter in Gavre. Back then the broadcaster was experimenting with it, and then after the race they got it got banned by the UCI in a first moment, but then UCI of course acknowledged that the extra value would be something. So I'm really glad we got to see the drone. They were Belgian operators handling the drone.
Jan Krommelink, the gentleman is called, apparently a former motocross rider who he had a heart attack, I think, and then he started flying drones as a sort of second career.
Can you clarify, was it on a wire through the woods, or was it an actual free-flying drone?
I know, it was not on a wire. And the thing is, that was the amazing thing, they were flying live. I mean, you can automate or you can program a drone to do a certain flight, but they didn't. So that was, in my sense, it was a bit risky. You can call it risky, but I loved it, of course, yeah.
Because I did see a big cable, and I thought that maybe it was a bit like those drones that they have in a football stadium where that, you know, it kind of flies above on wires. But this was a free-flying drone. I mean, you know, everyone always asks, when will this happen in the stage races? I guess flying it, 50 metres or 100 metres is a very different thing to flying it 200 kilometres.
Yeah, and the problem is the crowds. I mean, they had to shut off a section of the course in order to be able to fly the drone, didn't they? And I think there's already been a response from, I don't know whether the UCI, but people involved with broadcasting in road racing and involved in road racing have said that this is probably, under current rules, impossible. You would have to cut. I mean, I was thinking about the Poggio in San Remo would be a great place. If you shut off maybe the last, 500 meters of the Poggio, but maybe that robs some of the beauty of professional road cycling, that it does take place in an open to the public arena.
You could do it on the descent where crowds don't tend to gather, maybe. That would be dramatic, wouldn't it? The drone following the riders down the descent on the Poggio. Credit you with that idea, Daniel.
Yeah, and the drone can do things that the helicopter can't do, because the drones can get closer. And I think that's one of the major problems in incorporating the drone in a TV broadcast. It's the marriage with the helicopter isn't 100%, or the match isn't easy and might create extra risk. So, but I'm quite sure in the future there will be solutions for that.
Room Wi-Fi or linking my laptop to my phone to get online. I'm not particularly worried that people are going to steal trade secrets from the cycling podcast, but just a bit worried about, you know, the security of password data, bank login details, that kind of thing. There are, of course, other uses for a VPN. You definitely can't use it to watch Arsenal matches in Berlin, though. That's really not allowed. But if you want to see how NordVPN can keep your online security incredibly secure, watertight, in fact, you can get an exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/TCP. You'll get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan and a bonus gift. And it's also completely risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So that's nordvpn.com/TCP for the cycling podcast. You'll get a huge discount, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee if you don't like what you've bought.
Okay, chaps. Well, I think I said that we were going to be focusing on the Étoile de Bessèges and the Vuelta Valenciana in this part three. We're going to switch things up because Renard's a busy man. He's got to go off to the track to commentate on some track racing shortly. And we're going to talk instead. I said at the start of the show that Belgium will soon be crazy in love with an emerging rider. That rider is Arnaud Delis. It's a French name. He's from Wallonia, so I think I can pronounce it in French. Renard, Arnaud Delis. Lee spelled L-I-E, so literally Arnaud of Lies. Sounds like something that David Gourdou would call Arnaud Demar. He will turn, Renard, 21 2 days before Milan-San Remo. I predicted at the start of the year that he might win Milan-San Remo. He's got 12 wins already in his pro career. Two of them were last week in Étoile de Bessèges. As I said, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail later. He won on his third day as a pro last year in the Challenge Mallorca. Finished the season, his first season, sixth in the UCI ranking. So he's the talk of the sport at the moment. He's also charmed people with this, the backstory he has. He grew up on a farm in Wallonia. He's known as the Bull of Wallonia, I believe. He said he'll never leave from his farm, from Wallonia. He's responsible for 450 sheep on the family farm. So shades of kind of Thibaut Pinot. Renard, I believe that you've been to that family farm near Bastogne, near the halfway point of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and you've milked one of his cows. Is this true?
Well, yeah, there's a story to it. That's right. It's so true that I paid a visit to his family farm where he's still living. He still lives at home and is still helping at the farm. And if he's at home, and he said to me that he's not going to change that as long as he lives at home. If he's at home, he just helps at the farm. And one of the daily rituals of helping is milking the cow. So I got the chance of assisting him. I think the cows wouldn't have survived it if I would really have done the trick. So it was kind of adventurous. I got to wear his overall, you say that, his gear that he usually uses to milk the cows. And that was necessary because those cows have natural, how would I put it, natural things going on during the milking process, so it's kind of dangerous.
Was it pooing on you, Renard? Is that what you're saying?
Leave it out, Lionel. We don't have scatological content in the cycling podcast. Renard, was it one of the, I believe he has four cows, and this information is culled from a very good interview our colleague Gaëtan Chériard did for L'Équipe a few weeks ago. I think he has four cows that are of a special Swiss breed that he's particularly proud of. They're called Simone, Wachout, Sidonie and Noisette.
Yeah, he has a couple of cows that are not for slaughtering. I mean, I shouldn't tell that. But those are special cows, and they run around the farm. And if you go into the big barn, then suddenly this little cow comes, and yeah, it was the whole visit for me actually was unforgettable. I mean, not being in the milking department of the farm, but just the reception I got there by the Lee family was so warm and cheerful. It's in Belgian Luxembourg, that does exist, not to be switched with the other Luxembourg, and the way he's grounded with his feet to earth, I'm quite sure that is a solid basement to make a great career in cycling, because the guy doesn't need any mental coaching. He just has to live in his farm or stay at his farm, and it makes him so grounded that he has an advantage to a lot of other riders. As soon as he steps across the door at home, he's in a different world, and the mental process is of the risks and the stress and everything that combines with a high profile rider's career is gone. I mean, and that thing is, I think the whole farm and the whole background for Arnaud Delis is an extra asset to become one of the greatest classics riders ever, because that's nowadays the talk or the thing to say in Belgium, that he's going to be like something of a I'm searching for the correct word. He's going to be like a combination of Philippe Gilbert and Tom Bonen. That's the latest on Arnaud Delis.
Have there been any comparisons? It strikes me that he's palette of abilities is quite similar to Wout van Aert as well. I mean, he's won a lot of bunch sprints, but he doesn't see himself as a bunch sprinter. I mean, he's talked about this a lot. He doesn't want to be confined to that role. I think he won... The race that got him noticed by Lotto was the Belgian Junior Championships a couple of years ago, and he won with a 110-kilometer breakaway, and that's how he sees himself continuing.
Yeah, so true. Of course, he knows how to perform a good sprint, and I think he's a possible Grand Tour stage winner in every Grand Tour in the future. But he has more pedigree inside himself, so the cobbles, I also think... Certain races with climbs won't be impossible in the future, so we'll have to see how he develops as a rider. But I'm quite sure that the combination of talent and mental approach, he's more than a diamond in the rough.
Renaud, he has declared that Milan-San Remo is an objective, thankfully for me. But Lotto Destiny have also got a rider, Caleb Ewan, who has his sights set on that race, has had his sights set on that race for a while, has come pretty close to winning it. How will they play those two cards? Do you know?
I think Milan-San Remo really suits his abilities. We have to wait and see what happens till then, because that's still a while. And you know what they say about early wins. They don't always last. I mean, we don't know how good he is at the moment. Is he already 100%? I would hope for him he's not. If he's not, then his chances of winning Milan-San Remo are real. So I think that is the main thing there, following Arnaud Delis. Apart from his talent and his background, I can also acknowledge that the guy really is. It's such a simple guy, and I must say I was really charmed by his approach of everything, life, cycling, and if his cycling career doesn't turn out to be a big thing, then he just stick with the farm and he'll be happy. So that's a very nice thing.
Well, farming and cycling have always gone together, certainly up until 20 years or so. You know, we've seen a kind of different demographic has emerged in the last 20 years, but the number of great cyclists who come from farming families is quite extraordinary. I mean, I'll just give you a bit of an abridged list. Raymond Poulidor, Bernard Hinault, Fausto Coppi, Miguel Indurain, Sean Kelly, a man you know well, Lionel, Francesco Moser, Bernard Thévenet, Costante Girardengo, Joaquin Agostinho, Henny Kuiper, Adrie van der Poel, who we mentioned earlier. The list goes on and on and on.
Well, I think historically, there are probably more small holdings, more farmers. I mean, I'm out of my depth here talking about European farming trends, but, you know, cycling traditionally was a kind of an
who
escape.
Who did we have on? Oh, we had... Tobias Foss, Tobias Foss the other week told us that one of his great passions in life is to play Farming Simulator on his, I don't know,
brilliant,
Xbox or whatever.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, for a lot of people in, I don't know, the days gone by, cycling was an escape from the farm or the factory, wasn't it? And I suppose, a life on the road, racing around you know, some of the most beautiful parts of the world, especially if you're a young lad with... Or a young woman with athletic talent, why not? Well, Renaud, you tell me, would you rather be racing your bike all over the world, or would you rather be milking the cows? I mean, you're the only one of us, I think, who has experience of certainly cow milking.
Yeah. Well, from what I've experienced with Arnaud Delis, I think it's a golden combination, because the one thing, milking the cows is mental training, and it helps you on the bike. So psychology has become very important in cycling, but you're asking me the impossible choice for Arnaud Delis. I think he himself will never want to choose, but I think, of course, if you're not into farming, then you'll probably choose cycling above the cow shit, because that's what's happening there as well. You end up in the cow shit, milking the cows.
On that indecorous note, Renaud, I know the track centre or the track is beckoning. I know you need to get off and do your other job, which is commentating on the European Track Championships. Renaud, I'm going to thank you for your company today, and well, we will no doubt be seeing each other at a race pretty soon, and probably on the podcast as well. Thank you, Renaud, and enjoy the next few days.
Thanks for having me, Lionel and Daniel. Cheers.
Well, nice to hear from Renard there. Not from the horse's mouth, but from the cow's udders from Renard. I mean, wouldn't expect any.
I don't know. Yeah, Belgium's answer. I said Belgium's answer to Beyonce for UK listeners. Belgium's answer to Rebecca Luce, maybe. I don't know.
Oh, dear. He's literally out there. He's out there reporting in the field for us, isn't he? anyway, just on Arnaud Delis, because there is a lot of excitement about him just because of that versatility. I mean, you know, Belgians are notorious for getting carried away with young riders, hailing them as the new Eddy Merckx. I mean, I thought Renard was quite restrained there, saying that he's merely the combination of Tom Boonen and Philippe Gilbert. I mean, you know, that's really quite restrained. But I do think, you know, Delis, he is fast. And just looking at his amateur career and, you know, the races he's done well in so far, he's clearly versatile. And your prediction, I really hope for my sake you're not right about him winning Milan-San Remo, because it would be absolutely galling for me for you to get that right from so far out. But with Milan-San Remo and Caleb Ewan in the team, I mean, Ewan's been twice second at Milan-San Remo, missed it, of course, last year because he had a stomach bug in the days leading up to the race, and that really left Lotto Soudal, as they were then, kind of bereft. They had no real other cards to play. So going into a race as long as Milan-San Remo, where 1 minute a rider can be feeling great and thinking, yes, I'm going to be there on the Via Roma, and then the next minute the lights can go out very suddenly. Having two riders who could finish off a sprint, whether from a big group or a small group, is a good strategy. But also there's this fascinating aspect of beginner's luck and Milan-San Remo. Is it a race for the seasoned riders who know every inch of the Cipressa and the Poggio?
I think no.
The last time winner of Milan-San Remo, Mark Cavendish in 2009. That's a long time ago. Since then, it's not littered with, you know, green talent having, you know, pulled off their first.
Yeah, but there are a lot of guys who have had their best Milan-San Remo in their first appearance, going back over the years. And I've always had the impression that it's a race over which riders tend to tie themselves in mental knots as the years go by, particularly riders who should, in theory, have a Milan-San Remo in their palmarès, guys like Peter Sagan. I mean, even going back to Eddy Merckx in the 60s, it was the first big classic that he won, and he obviously, well, he won seven in total. But, you know, that was an example as well of it being the first breakthrough victory for a rider that went on to win a lot of classics. You know, you could argue, I think it was Wout van Aert's first monument, wasn't it? But it is a race that I've always felt that people can overthink. And, you know, I always talk every single year, I talk about hesitation being the key deciding factor in people not winning Milan-San Remo. And it is almost a race where it can possibly pay to switch your brain off for 7 hours or however long it takes.
Absolutely. It's the race where the riders have to be in the moment. Not Milan-San Remo, Mindfulness-San Remo, maybe. I don't know. Sort of just have to live in the moment and take whatever comes at you. But I think on Delis, I think it would, you know, there needs to be something, maybe another step between the point he's at now and winning Milan-San Remo. Maybe, you know, if he wins Kerner, Brussels Kerner, I'll be with you, you know, in thinking that he has a great shout for, well, the first monument of the year.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, our longest-serving supporters. Longest-serving? Longest-standing supporters. Well, they are serving because they've served me up a box of Science in Sport goodies, and I'm in great company with my Science in Sport products because they support a range of the world's finest sports teams with their range of nutrition products. As we know, they've been supporting Ineos Grenadiers since 2015 when they were Team Sky, of course. Also supporters and suppliers to the German Cycling Federation, the Australian Cycling Federation, British Rowing, Harlequins Rugby Team, the Milwaukee Bucks, the NBA basketball team, and Daniel.
You're deliberately not mentioning Arsenal.
No, well, officially, cover your ears, Daniel. Also, Tottenham Hotspur, who became a partner of Science in Sport in 2022, and fueling Tottenham Hotspur to, I don't know, what, third or fourth place in the Premier League, and I don't know. I don't want to alienate fifth. Tottenham supporters.
Probably fifth or sixth.
Don't want to alienate Tottenham supporters there. Check out the full Science in Sport range at scienceinsport.com.
Lionel, after that, we shall proceed. Renard no longer with us, with our analysis, our chat about the weekend's racing. As I said last week, so much racing, it's like a game of Cluedo, piecing together who won where and how. It got me thinking, Lionel, I think we should ask the listeners, is there anyone out there among our listeners, I'm sure there is, who believes that they watch every minute of available cycle racing over the course of a season? Do you know what, Simon Mottram, another former sponsor of ours, he is still the founder of Rafa Clothing, he once told me that he watches everything, absolutely everything. I watch most things, but on repeat. A lot of it's on repeat.
I really struggle on repeat. It has to be live for me, sport. I watched the cyclocross on catch-up because I was away over the weekend, but I was really... Everyone who messaged me, who's even vaguely connected to cycling over the weekend, the first thing I said back was, no spoilers, please. I can't watch it with the same level of intensity if I know the outcome. I don't mind watching it a second time and trying to pick up some nuance to the racing, certainly with the big classics or mountain stages in the Tour, what have you. But I like to watch it without knowing what's going to happen. That's the essence of live sport for me. But you're odd of watching it, knowing all the results. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I get spoiled. I watch football matches live, but they still get spoiled by usually my dad texting me 3 or 4 seconds before something significant happens, because the pictures arrive at different times in different places. And it takes a while to get to Germany. Lionel, to the racing. Two big stage races finished at the weekend, the Vuelta Valenciana. I think it's got a more convoluted name than that, but we'll call it the Vuelta Valenciana. And the Étoile de Bessèges. Now, last week, our episode was called Interstellar Domination, I think. And that was because Intermarché were celebrating topping the world rankings. Well, they had another fantastic week in Valenciana, or on the Valencia coast, because Rui Costa, their veteran Portuguese rider, we talked about them upcycling older riders. Rui Costa is a good example of that. And he won the final stage and he nicked the overall as well. And well, this certainly surprised Giulio Ciccone, who was marooned in the group behind Rui Costa, attacked behind, we sort of countered behind Timon Arensman and snuck away. Ciccone didn't have any teammates to help him at that point. And yeah, it was a bit of a heist. It was a bit of a hold-up. Rui Costa, really curious rider. I find Lionel a very difficult rider to categorize, to pigeonhole. I mean, what is a Rui Costa? He sort of exists on a kind of Iberian peninsula of my outer consciousness. I was trying to think earlier in the week whether I've interviewed him. And I think I've interviewed him several times, but this is not any sort of comment on how interesting or not he is in interviews. But he's a rider who escapes my sort of understanding. He's good at a lot of different things. Won 3 consecutive Tours de Suisse. We once christened him the Asparagus. He was one of those riders alongside Simon Spillack, didn't we? Because he was always in bloom, sort of late spring. If you're an Asparagus in Germany, it'd be slightly earlier in April. Asparagus is like a religion in Germany in April. But he was always very good in May and June, wasn't he? And is enjoying a bit of an Indian summer, well, certainly based on the first few weeks of this season.
Yeah, and he's... well, doing it for the old guys, isn't he? Or maybe he's beating the trend for ever younger riders. He rode with the vigour of 2 18-year-olds at the weekend, didn't he? Yeah, I agree. He's tricky to pigeonhole, not really a Grand Tour contender. Very good, as you say, in the Tour de Suisse, but hasn't really backed that up with any other major performances in similar types of stage races. I remember the first Tour de France stage he won way back in 2011. It was at Superbest, which was one of those kind of, almost mystical climbs in the Massif Central. And he really sort of picked the pockets of Cadel Evans was up there. Samuel Sanchez was up there. I'm looking back at the results now to remind myself who was also, behind. But it was a kind of a, he went on a sort of medium range raid. And that was the moment that he really announced himself on the biggest stage. Won the world title, of course, with...
The moment he announced himself on the biggest stage was when... Did he throw a wheel or have a wheel thrown at him by Carlos Barredo at the end of a Tour de France stage? I think even earlier than that.
It may well have been, yeah. He won the world title with a sort of, you know, slightly ghostly effort as well, didn't he? Got away in the two of them, Joaquin Rodriguez, and well, at the time I can remember thinking, well, this is Rodriguez to lose, and he did lose it. Rui Costa kind of picked his pocket a bit, didn't he, in the sprint? And he's gone to Intermarché, and well, you don't want to just repeat the phrase, the upcycling, but in a team that probably demands a few results, he's pulled one off there with the final stage and the overall classification. And a long career now. You look back, started out at Benfica, many years with Castapan that became Movistar, and then Lamprey, and then UAE Team Emirates. And it looked like, you know, retirement was just around the corner, but a sort of an Indian summer in the spring for him.
Lionel, before we talk about another theme you alluded to earlier, the sort of baby, I won't call them baby boomers, but the baby bloomers, the 20, well, sort of 18 to 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds thriving everywhere. There was one as well in Valenciana. We'll maybe mention that in a minute. Let's talk about another rider, a resurgent rider in Valenciana. I mentioned in the news roundup, Theo Gegenhardt won for the first time since that Giro d'Italia win in 2020. He looked in outstanding form all week, and he finally got his win in, I suppose, the Queen stage. Now, he, I think on social media, he's talked about what a great winter he had, just an undisturbed winter. I remember speaking to him at the start of the winter. He talked about how much he was looking forward to just avoiding airports for a few months and really just being sort of settled at home. I think he spent a lot of the winter in London and just had an uninterrupted build up to 2023. Maybe, I mean, we'll probably talk to him in the next few weeks and ask him a bit more about this, but maybe mimicking a little bit of what he experienced in that COVID season, which then allowed him to perform so well in the Giro d'Italia.
Bit of a monkey off his back, that, isn't it? The first win since the COVID Giro. I mean, it's a fair old time ago now, isn't it? Over, well, 2.5 years almost, isn't it? So a long time for a rider of his ability and profile to go. But he's in that team where if you're not absolutely on the very, very top level, it's very, very easy to get shunted down the order and find not even being the sort of the first climbing domestique, but being the second or third in stage races. Being, you know, even though he is a Grand Tour winner, there's a lot of uncertainty about what his season might look like. I don't know whether you've got any intel on that, Daniel, but listener Richard Dawson asked to write, what do you think Theo Gegenhardt's season looks like? It's been a fairly quiet time for him, wondering if he still has a leadership position at Ineos. I'm assuming he means for the Grand Tours. But with their, you know, roster of riders, you know, the first race to win is to get into the team for your Grand Tour of choice. And then the second race is to get the leadership position, or at least a co-leadership position. And that's before you start thinking about riders from other teams and actually getting onto the road. It's a real tricky position for, you know, anyone in a team like Ineos Grenadiers, and I think the same applies to Jumbo-Visma. So perhaps with him, you know, striking out and getting himself a stage win, I think he got relegated a couple of days before that, didn't he? For which I thought was a little bit harsh. But clearly he's come out of the blocks this spring, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what the team has in store for him as the season unfolds.
Another British rider, Lionel, and this does bring us to what I call the baby bloomers. Thomas Gloag, sixth Gloag. I get the pronunciation yips every time I have to pronounce his name. G-L-O-A-G, and he's English. He was sixth on GC, and he was second on the Queen stage, and he's 21. He's from London, I believe. And he's a rider who I think could have joined Ineos Grenadiers, decided to go down a different path, join Jumbo-Visma. And one of this, I suppose we're now in the third wave. L'Equipe had a piece the other day about the United Kingdom waiting for its second wave of cycling stars after the initial burst of the Wigginses and the Cavendishes. I think we're really on the third generation now, aren't we? And there are a lot of them. I mean, we talked about it, Lionel, didn't we, over text message over the weekend, about guys like Sam Watson at Groupama FDJ. I mean, there are almost more than you can keep track of, and we'll talk in a second about the Ineos riders at Bessege. But Gloag certainly looks like an outstanding climbing prospect.
Yeah, he does. And funny, we're talking about the sort of the farming heritage of so many of the great riders. This wave of British riders are almost the complete opposite, aren't they? They're the sort of the hipsters from, you know, London in a lot of cases, Ethan Hayter, Fred Wright, Theo Gegenhardt, of course. And I think that says a lot about the kind of the wave of people who got interested in cycling during the Bradley Wiggins, Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas years. But also, I think
a lot of them have fathers.
Yeah, parents.
A lot of them have fathers and mothers who are cyclists.
Cycling families.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it stands to reason, doesn't it? There are a lot more cycling families around now, and so yeah, there's been a real kind of, you know, a kind of quiet revolution in the profile and status of cycling in the UK, and it's no longer a kind of a quirky, you know, slightly oddball pursuit that it was back in my day when, you know, really the sport was dominated by a sort of small handful of countries. You know, Britain has got its own type of riders coming from a certain type of background. You know, I'm not saying that excludes anybody else, but there's definitely, you know, almost a cause and effect you can draw between that kind of wave from, you know, 10, 12 years ago to now. And yeah, seeing young riders coming through without any fear. You know, there's no sense that this sport is alien to them. And there's also none of that historical legacy of slight mistrust of riders who don't come from the, you know, the core European heartland. You know, big European teams will take without question young British riders because, firstly, they've got data to go on, of course. But secondly, it's no longer unusual. And so, yeah, Groupama FDJ have really, you know, tapped into young British riders in a way, I guess, you know, Peugeot was probably one of the only foreign teams to do that consistently back in the late 70s and early 80s with Roger Leger as the boss, who was a real Anglophile. So, yeah, it's been interesting watching and completely different to, you know, the landscape when I came into cycling. There's a lot of talk about the sort of withering of the domestic scene here, which undoubtedly, you know, does have an impact, does have consequences, but there is nevertheless a pathway for talented riders to make it to the very highest level. And yeah, there's going to be some big wins from some of those lads, I think.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the young riders who did come to prominence in the Étoile de Bessège, and particularly on the last day in the time trial. Josh Tarling, who was second in the time trial at age 18. Incidentally, I make that his joint worst ever finish in a time trial. He's won pretty much every time trial he's ever done. I think he finished second in a time trial when he was a junior 2 or 3 years ago at age 15 or 16, but otherwise he's won every one. He's 18. Ben Tula, third. He's age 21. The Frenchman, Kevin Vauclin, fourth in the TT. He was also climbing pretty strongly all week. And then we mentioned Arnaud Delis as well, taking his two stage wins. Mathias Skelmoser won the Queen's stage. He's 22. I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter, Lionel. Just what a seismic shift this is for professional cycling. One that, if you had started to follow this sport in the last 2 or 3 years, you might not necessarily appreciate the magnitude of it and how different this is from, as you said, you know, the period when we both got into the sport, and 23 was still considered extremely young, and a victory by a 23-year-old in any kind of race, whether it be early season or in the middle of the season, would be the subject of a lot of hype. Any 23 or even a 24-year-old doing very well would have got people talking in the same vein. You know, we were talking earlier about Arnaud Delis being a hybrid of, I don't know, Boonen and Gilbert. That kind of hype did greet anyone at those kind of ages who used to succeed early in their career.
I don't want to paint with too broad a brush here, but I mean, bear in mind late 90s, early 2000s, what the era you're kind of referring to, where there was almost a, well, there was a secret graduation that many riders had to go through in terms of, you know, being initiated to the industrial doping that was going on in most, if not all, teams. Yeah, I'm hesitant to say this means that, you know, every corner of the peloton is squeaky, squeaky clean, but I think that, you know, it's a much more honest, a much kinder environment to come into. I mean, you'd have to be incredibly cynical to usher teenagers into the sort of environment that riders in the 90s and early 2000s or 2000s had to come into. And I said that sort of sense of suspicion from team managers, and you know, cycling has been a very traditional sport. You know, what was good for the previous era is good for the current one. Some of those attitudes do still exist. I mean, we were talking last week about Hilaire van der Schuylen. I mean, he's 75 years old. I mean, you know, he probably thinks that a rider doesn't come into their own until they're 32, you know. There's much less of that sense that riders have to be a certain age before they can start performing. I think a lot of that is down to the way that the World Tour teams are structured, the fact that there are so many events and there are ways to expose riders, you know, gradually. You know, Josh Tarling, you know, is following in the footsteps of sort of Ben Turner and Ben Tulett in the sense of getting a little taste early, and then they'll manage his race program. There's not the need to kind of use up and burn up riders and use them as kind of roster fodder that again would have been the way that that World Tour teams were selected for races, because, you know, they have 30 riders to choose from. And yeah, there's also the data to go on. That's the other thing. They know that they're good enough. They're looking at the numbers, but they're not looking at the age as the most significant number.
I'm still sort of intrigued by the physiological dimension of this. There has been a bit of a dogma in endurance sport about endurance being something that's acquired with age. I mean, if you look at marathon running, for example, it's always been the preserve of runners, at distance runners at towards the end of their career. That's been a choice thing in a lot of cases, that they've tended to, I guess it's the prestige of the track. Runners tend to want to experience that before then moving on to marathons. But it got me thinking about whether there is any trace, any evidence of a similar kind of trend in marathon running. Is anyone succeeding, thriving at similar ages, late teens, early 20s? Lionel, we should talk about the winner of the Étoile de Bessèges, and in many ways, the man of the early season, certainly as far as the French races are concerned. I said that you watched him win the GP La Marseillaise last week. He is a young rider as well, 26 years of age, Nielsen Paulus. And Lionel, and I spoke to him yesterday, in fact, about his outstanding start to this 2023 season. Let's hear Nielsen Paulus, shall we?
It's kind of strange coming home after winning a few races. I feel like I went through this also when I won San Sebastian a few years ago. You kind of come off of this incredible high at the bike race that you've just won this big event and it's all this celebrating, and then you kind of go home and it's sort of straight back into just daily life, you know. It's it's like nothing really changes too much. Like, stuff changes, but at the same time nothing really changes. And I don't know, I think it's kind of nice to come home and just feel normal again, just back into daily life and back into a nice routine with my wife and at home in Nice. And good to step away from it all after you have a good result like that. Keeps you grounded, I guess.
Everyone talks always about the importance of momentum for teams particularly, but also I guess for individual riders at the start of the year, how that can really release pressure and release a burden. Are you experiencing any kind of that relief, or are you very much thinking that you've got bigger fish to fry later on in the season?
Definitely. I mean, no matter where you're going, it's always hard to win bike races, especially nowadays. There aren't really many easy races left. So just being able to win one, and I mean, I would say I was able to win two, and it's a pretty amazing feeling. And last year I was killing myself trying to win a race, and I wasn't able to do it until Japan at the very end of the year. So the fact that it's already happened for me in February is a really nice feeling, and I feel like it just frees up the mental space to just focus on the day-to-day preparation and training and focus. And I don't know, when I went from Marseille to Passage, it just felt like I didn't really need to force anything. I felt solid, and every day I felt solid. I had a day that I completely like fell apart or anything like that. I just mentally and physically felt pretty strong every day. So all I had to do was just kind of go through the motions and just race my bike, use all the skills that I've been trying to grow over the past few years. And yeah, I mean, I'm just really happy it all just came together, and it feels like something that can be repeated as well.
I mean, maybe you feel as though winning in Japan last year was a bit of a breakthrough, maybe unlocked something, but also just talk to me a bit about the winter and to what extent you saw and felt this coming. Because I mean, I looked at your Instagram and I can see for December, I can see donuts, I can see I can see kayaks, I can see a beautiful, I don't know whether it's a Chinese or Korean meal, but so talk to me a bit about the sort of work you did over the winter and anything in particular that you were working on or concentrating on.
I had a few people ask me what kind of things I did over the winter to reach a seemingly new level. In all honesty, I've had winters where I've trained too hard and come into the season tired, and other seasons where I've trained too easy and the races were just well beyond what I was capable of at the time. So I feel like having gone through those periods in the past really helped me this winter I feel like I finally got it right this winter with, you know, not training too hard, not training too easy, not overcomplicating things. Going back to America, it's always refreshing, because when you go back, cycling isn't a very big deal in the States. At least I feel like the cycling fan base is so spread out that that you never really feel, apart from, you know, the family support, you never feel like somebody special, which is nice. I think it's good to be grounded in reality like that, and you just have to, you know, take each training day as like going out and getting the work done, not overthinking it. Just, you know, if you feel bad, it doesn't matter, because, you know, it's still a job and you have to do your job. And feel good, just enjoy those good days. And I really just tried to not overcomplicate things and tried to, you know, not push too hard, not push too, just pulling together all the experiences I had over the last few winters and things I went wrong, things I did wrong and things I did right, and tried to piece them all together and enjoy time with family and go out and get the work done.
Yeah, because you, I looked at previous seasons, you'd started later, you tended to start a little bit later, hadn't you, UAE, but I think you had one experience in the COVID season of starting earlier, starting in Australia, and it seemed to go pretty well then. But, you know, there is a school of thought that certain riders are just very good at certain times of the year, and I don't know, maybe you feel now that actually going forward, early February might be quite a fertile period for you.
Yeah, the biggest thing is that I tend to gain fitness pretty fast, which is, it's a good and bad thing. Like, it's a blessing and a curse, because gaining fitness fast works really well if you don't overdo it. Because gaining fitness really fast tended to put me in a situation where, you know, I'm feeling good, it's early, so like, why not just push a little more and see how far we can take this. The fact that I gained fitness early just put me into a difficult situation where, like, I thought I would just continue to get better and better forever, but that's just not realistic. This winter, I just tried to hold myself back a little bit more, just really pay attention to not overdoing things, and then being able to start the season a little bit earlier, just because I tend to gain fitness pretty fast. Starting earlier wasn't really an issue, and it was just, yeah, kind of something we tried out a bit newer this year. And it seemed to work out really well. So still have to keep things under control with, taking proper rest. There's always the risk that, at some point the fitness might run out. But for now, I'm feeling really solid, and just have to pay attention and take rest when it's needed. Just enjoy the fitness I've got.
I mean, the win at the weekend, it kind of underlined, I suppose, and as well, La Marseille has underlined that you're a guy with a lot of different abilities, so much so that you're a difficult rider to pigeonhole, and there might be a bit of a danger in that, in the sense that, for example, I believe you're going to try the Cobble Classics for the first time this year.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of curious, is it still a bit of a voyage of discovery for you every season in terms of just zooming in on what you're best at? Or is that something, some riders are determined not to become pigeonholed, and they sort of take great joy in the fact that they are very versatile and they're good at different things: stage races, one day races, cobbles, Ardennes, and so on.
I feel like I've found myself and the rider I think I am. I don't think it's very easy to pin down exactly what that is, but
I mean, what are you bad at? What are you bad at, Niels? Maybe it's easiest to work by elimination. What aspect of bike racing do you really think you're not good at and you really don't like?
I don't think there's anything about bike racing that I particularly don't like. I mean, honestly, I found enjoyment out of just about every race I've gone to. I mean, as long as I'm fit. If I'm just fit, then I feel like I can perform in almost any race on any terrain, like whether it's just a flat windy stage or a mountain stage, or I don't know, fingers crossed for the cobbles this year. That's kind of a new voyage for me, but I'm really excited to try it out.
Are you going there more in hope, or is there a degree of expectation that's maybe also come from, I don't know, people in your team like Andreas Klier? I mean, they know everything about the classics, and have people with great knowledge of the classics told you, no, you're going to be good there? Or is it a complete, as I say, voyage into the unknown for you?
It's a voyage.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, I had a good ride in the cobbles in the Tour de France last year, which kind of was getting me thinking about trying out a cobble classic. And I mean, obviously I raced that race a lot differently than I would a typical cobble classic. One, because it was much shorter than a cobble classic, but also because I was in the breakaway with only four riders. That being said, I still really had a lot of fun on that day. And just based on, you know, watching Flanders in the last few years, it's always just been such a fun race to watch. And racing in Leuven a few years ago at World Championships just really opened my eyes to the fan base that's in Belgium. And I just think it would be an awesome experience. So, I mean, I don't know if I'll be, who knows if I'm going to be competitive, and I hope I will be competitive, but at the end of the day, I just want the challenge. And yeah, I just love racing my bike no matter what the terrain is, so I'd like to have that experience.
I was just curious, a couple of years ago at the Tour de France, obviously, well, you got a lot of attention, not least because you were riding really well and you were in a lot of breakaways in that tour, but people became aware of your native North American heritage, and people found out that, you know, your paternal grandfather is part of the Oneida. I was just wondering, you know, you gave a couple of interviews in that tour where you said, you know, you'd contacted community leaders, or they'd contacted you rather, and this was something that you and particularly your sister as well wanted to carry forward. I was just doing a bit of reading that, you know, the kind of issues you talked about in the interviews there, how difficult life was, particularly for the Oneida people. They're very much ongoing. I mean, right up until a couple of weeks ago, the stories about lack of drinking water and so on and so forth. I was just wondering, is that something that's very much or even more in your thoughts after a couple of weeks like the ones that you've just had?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely something that's, you know, part of my identity and where I ground myself from. Cycling is giving me a really great chance to, you know, grow my image and my following and the voice that I could potentially have to down the road be able to better serve the Native American communities. And yeah, I mean, everything that I can do to sort of elevate that community, especially down the road when I have hopefully more of a following, more of an image, more of a voice, that's going to be pretty important to me to use that to their benefit. So hopefully I can continue this hot streak and continue to climb the ranks a bit and put all of that to good use.
Well, Lionel, we talked a couple of minutes ago about Theo Gegenhardt and the obviously good winter that he had, good preparation in terms of it being settled, it being stable. And you heard Nielsen Paulus there talk about how he seemed to have found a sweet spot of not doing too much, not doing too little in the off season this year, and he has started like a rocket.
Indeed he has, and interesting there hearing him talk about the Cobble Classics possibly being on the race program. When I spoke to his teammate Simon Carr, he seemed to be under the impression that sort of the classics a little bit later, maybe Amstel Gold and Liège-Bastogne-Liège would be on the menu, and maybe they will as well. But you know, Nielsen Paulus I think back to last year's Tour de France and that day on the cobbles where EF Education really, well, they played a blinder, didn't they? They got Paulus, who you might have assumed would be a kind of a, you know, slightly soft touch on the cobbles. They got him away with the kind of the gnarly classics man, Magnus Cort, you know, to sort of, I don't know, babysit him across the cobbles. And actually he looked very, very comfortable and came within 13 seconds of getting the yellow jersey that day. Now, I know there is no real relation between that stage on the cobbles and a full Tour of Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, but still, cobbles are cobbles.
Yeah, I was looking forward to seeing the treatment of this stage in the forthcoming Netflix Tour de France documentary. I heard there was some quite eye-catching or eye-watering scenes. However, I've also learned from a bloke in a pub that those particular scenes may not have made the final cut, which I'm slightly disappointed about, I must say.
Wow, I remember that really, really well because it all flared up because Robbie McEwen kind of dug out Alberto Bettiol for riding hard across the cobbles and narrowing the gap and denying Paulus a chance to get the yellow jersey. And then once this controversy, you know, was flickering, EF, Jonathan Vaughters in particular, seemed to kind of fan the flames and seemed to want to kind of pour petrol on the controversy, perhaps thinking that it was their way to get some, you know, big airtime in the Netflix documentary. I mean, I'm being slightly... slightly frivolous there. But no, he was, you know, those few days, you know, riding with that kind of the yellow jersey really within touching distance. Remember, he almost took it the next day on the long stage to Longwy when Van Aert did that crazy attack. And then Pogacar, well, it kind of seemed to rile up Pogacar on the final climb. And he kept Paulus out of yellow by just 4 seconds. And then Paulus slipped away a little bit on the stage to La Planche de Belfi. But, you know, real kind of, you know, standout few days for him there. And he's a rider who now has demonstrated that he can do a lot of different things. The San Sebastian ride, I still think, was, you know, was outstanding when he won that race, the way he won it. And, well, as we talked a little bit last week, he's set his stall out early. A couple of decent wins there. I mean, the Étoile de Bessèges and the Grand Prix La Marseillaise are not, you know, huge races, but as they say, you can only beat what's in front of you. And you know, he's put it all together there. Should just mention, because I don't think you mentioned it in the roundup, the stage that were cancelled with the huge pile up around 22 kilometers from the finish, and some pretty dramatic pictures. I think it was Valentin Ferron hanging over the wall, and a long and short of it was that the stage was cancelled simply because there were no longer enough vehicles, ambulances able to provide backup to the remaining peloton. I mean, it was a, you know, quite a shocking crash, that one, wasn't it? The stage was completely cancelled. So quite a light week's racing, all told, wasn't it? Short stages, punchy stages. And just going back to your comment about younger riders and endurance, there's a world of difference between this and, you know, a 260-kilometre classic. But we'll see how Paulus gets on. He's certainly going to be a man to watch this spring.
Yeah, and I think Lionel as well, he's in the right team in the sense that EF Education, they tend to go into races with lots of different options, with lots of freedom for a lot of riders in the team. It's not the kind of team that will be systematically rally around one pre-designated leader. And I think him exploring the full sort of extremities of his abilities is a good idea, because, you know, I don't know whether it's because of the connection with San Sebastian, the San Sebastian Classic, but when I think of his different abilities, bring to mind someone like Tony Gallopin, is a rider who won San Sebastian, always did really well in San Sebastian, but became a little bit stymied later in his career, or has become, because maybe he tried to repeat that sort of kind of opportunistic win like Paulus's in San Sebastian when he won there, and like Paulus's win in the GP La Marseillaise a couple of weeks ago. But the higher Paulus's stock rises, the more difficult it's going to be to pull off that kind of victory, isn't it? Those sort of long range solo moves. So, you know, I think it's probably wise to explore what else he can achieve, and I'm sure he'll achieve an awful lot this year. Lionel, I think that just about concludes the entertainment for the week. There'll be more racing, lots of racing going on at the weekend, Tour of Oman. Not sure who we're going to have back next week. This podcast will be referred to the Premier League Referees Committee too, and they'll deliberate on whether you get welcome back next week or whether VAR judges that you should get a second yellow for piss taking this week's pod and incur a suspension.
I mean, well, it's been almost 90 minutes, hasn't it, Daniel? So, I mean, the football analogies just keep on going.
We will see you all next week. Thank you for your company.
Thank you, Daniel.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.